This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I'd like to welcome you to the UCSD Department of Pediatrics and Rady Children's Grand Rounds, for this morning. It also happens to be the 19th annual Lenore Hamburger Lectureship. It was established by Dr. Hamburger in 1999. Dr. Hamburger would have been 95 years old this month, but he passed away 4 years ago. He was professor of emeritus for the 20 years that I knew him, but before that, he was one of the founding fathers of UCSD School of Medicine. He was actually appointed the assistant dean of the School of Medicine in 1964, so really one of the first years of the medical school. The Lenore Hamburger Lectureship is something that's gone on every single year, and I'll tell you a little bit about the focus of it. I'll tell you first about Dr. Hamburger. He had research interests on the prevention and treatment of IgE-mediated diseases. He was the first chief of the Division of Pediatric Immunology and Allergy between 1970 and 1990, and he really established one of the preeminent training programs in the country and therefore had a major impact on allergist immunologists all around the country. He was responsible for training dozens of allergy immunology fellows who have now practiced locally, but also around the world. He retired from the university in 1990, but he really continued to be actively involved for many more years after that. He was real involved in education, in fellows, residents, medical school education. There's actually also a Hamburger Award for the medical students who write the best project for their last year. He also was attending over here at Rady Children's Hospital. Robert was a real supporter of universal access to medical care, and that's really one of the main motivations for this lecture series. He had a particular interest in health disparities in this country, particularly the African-American experience. In 1999, he established this lectureship in memory of the wife of one of his first allergy immunology fellows, Dr. Michael Lenore, who now is a practicing allergist in the Bay Area. Dr. Lenore's wife, Andrea, actually died during a severe asthma attack during that fellowship here in San Diego at a really young age. So the lectureship has two themes: prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of asthma, allergy, and immunologic diseases, and also health disparities. So without further ado, I'd like to invite Dr. Haygood to come up and introduce our speaker.
Thanks, Hal. I can't think of a better speaker for the Lenore Hamburger Lecture because Dr. Celadon works both in asthma and in health disparities and has done really high-impact work in the intersection of those fields. So I'm going to try to be brief, which is difficult because Juan has accomplished a lot. He and I were born in the same hometown, Barranquilla, Colombia. Juan grew up there and then went to the Javeriana University in Bogota, where he studied medicine. He did his residency at Lincoln Hospital and Beth Israel Medical Center in New York City, and then a fellowship in pulmonary critical care medicine at Brown University, and then went to Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston as a research fellow, and then went to the Channing Lab also as a research fellow, and during that time got his MPH and DRPH in genetic epidemiology. He joined the faculty at Harvard in the Department of Medicine and very quickly rose through the ranks from instructor to associate professor, which is unusual in the Harvard system. He was recruited to Pittsburgh in 2010 as the Niels Djerna Endowed Professor of Pediatrics and Division Chief of Pediatric Pulmonology, Allergy, Immunology. He's also joint appointments in medicine, genetics, and epidemiology at University of Pittsburgh. He is a member of a large number of boards and committees internationally, really worldwide, in asthma, environmental health, health disparities, and diversity. He is the Secretary Treasurer of the American Thoracic Society this year, which means that in 2 years he'll be the president of that worldwide society. He has won numerous mentoring and teaching awards through his career, He's a member of the AFCI and AAP, and remarkably has two former mentees who are also members of the AFCI, which I think is a tremendous accomplishment. He has over 200 publications in genetics, epidemiology, gene by environment interactions, health disparities, and social determinants of health. He's a PI on four large NIH grants, including a T32 training grant. I think he is what I would consider the rare quintuple threat: physician, scientist, educator, administrator, and advocate. I'm very much looking forward to what he has to share with us today.
So thanks, Jim, for that most kind introduction. Thanks to Hal and Jim for their kind invitation. I've truly enjoyed my time in San Diego. What a beautiful city. It was 1 degree in Pittsburgh on Wednesday, and to come to 70 degrees as a treat. So there are two companies that donate medications to give free of cost to children participating in two of my NIH-funded studies, PharmaByte and Merck. That's the only disclosure. I receive no compensation from any of these companies. As you all know, asthma is the most common chronic respiratory disease of childhood, and it's enormously expensive. You know, in 2007, $15.5 billion direct cost for asthma. Last week, there was a new article estimating this broadly $80 billion. You know, so either way you look at it, it causes a lot of costs and suffering. But it's not an equal opportunity disease at all. So asthma is more common among the poor, and it's more common in certain racial or ethnic groups. But there is something very curious. So if you look at this, it would appear as if blacks had, and people of multiple races had, the highest prevalence of childhood asthma. And Hispanics have a relatively low prevalence. But this is a fallacy. Once you divide Hispanics into subgroups, Puerto Ricans have the highest prevalence of childhood asthma in the U.S., and Mexicans the lowest. This is known as the Hispanic paradox. This was first identified for cardiovascular mortality, and since then we have learned that Puerto Ricans have the greatest burden in terms of prevalence, morbidity, and mortality from asthma of all ethnic groups in the U.S., and Mexican Americans have the lowest burden of asthma. You observe this for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD as well, and also for prematurity. Puerto Rican women deliver the most preemies in the U.S., and Mexican women the fewest. You do not see these paradoxical findings for obesity and diabetes, which disproportionately affects both groups. So this is why, whereas Hispanic is maybe important from a political viewpoint, it's a complete fallacy from a biomedical research viewpoint. These are five individuals who would self-identify as Hispanic in the U.S. Census, because the U.S. Census defines Hispanics as any person with roots in a territory that was previously under Spanish domain. So here you have Rigoberta Menchú, a Mayan from Guatemala, who won the Nobel Peace Prize. You have Alberto Fujimori, who would check Hispanic because he's Peruvian, even though his parents are Japanese. And you have two players from my favorite team, the Red Sox: Mike Lowell, who's Puerto Rican of Cuban descent, he's predominantly European, and David Papi Ortiz, who just retired, who's predominantly African, he's Dominican. And in the middle, you have my comadre, Shakira, who's from my hometown, Barranquilla. And Shakira is half Colombian, half Lebanese, so all of these people would be Hispanic. So why do you observe these disparities? The first thing that I will tell you, it is multifactorial. That's why this problem has to be tackled, you know, from multiple angles. There are factors at the individual level and at the community level. Some are not modifiable, like genetics, but the rest are potentially modifiable and include things like socioeconomic status, indoor pollution, environmental tobacco smoke, perhaps vitamin D status, exposure to violence and stress, access to care, literacy. At the community level, some of the same determinants, and then you have things like outdoor air pollution. And the wheel goes round and round. So during my career, at various points, either I or people I've trained have concentrated on different aspects of this. So the first thing I will talk to you about today is racial ancestry. So these are data for ancestry determined by genetic markers, global genetic ancestry, in 678 Puerto Rican children in one of our NIH-funded studies. They are the red dots. Here you have proportion of African ancestry, here you have proportion of European ancestry, and here you have proportion on the top of Native American ancestry. On average, Puerto Ricans are 60 to 65% European, 20 to 25% African, and about 10% Native American. But there is tremendous individual variation. So some Puerto Ricans may be solely European, like this kid here. Some may be more African. So in this study, what we look at was proportion of African ancestry and lung function. And what we found was that as the proportion of African ancestry increased in these children, their lung function, as determined by pre- and post-bronchodilator, FEV1, FEC, was decreased, even after adjusting for numerous factors confounding. This is highly consistent with a prior paper in African-American adults that showed the same inverse relationship. However, African-Americans have on average 75% African ancestry, whereas Puerto Ricans, as I told you, have 25% African ancestry. So the findings were replicated to a T. I'm now going to take you to Costa Rica. And please forgive me, but North Americans are not known by their geographic knowledge. So when I was back in Boston, you know, at an early meeting, we were discussing doing this study in Costa Rica, and a Harvard professor stood up and said, "Well, Celedon, if you're going to do research in Costa Rica, you have to talk to me. I practically own the island." So, bless your heart. So here you have adolescents and adults in Costa Rica. They would be the green dots. And here you have proportion of European, Native American, and African ancestry. And these are Wei Chen and John Brehm who carried out this study. And as you can see, the ancestral, the ancestry of this Costa Rican adolescent is very different. So they are predominantly European and Native American with very little African ancestry. And in Costa Ricans, what we show is the opposite phenomenon, whereas the proportion of Native American ancestry is directly and positively associated with lung function. And there is a trend for an inverse relationship with COPD. So at this point, there are numerous studies conducted by our group and others. This is a meta-analysis, and this is asthma versus ancestry in racially admixed Hispanic children. And what you observe is the same, you know, for Native American ancestry is inversely related with asthma risk. For African ancestry is positively associated with asthma risk. This is consistent with this Hispanic paradox findings that I first described, right? Puerto Ricans have greater African ancestry. Mexicans have very, very low. They have more Native American ancestry. And if you look at data from Latin America, this is very consistent. So I didn't show you some other data that we and others have shown, but I think this is now fairly consistent. So the question is, how is this operating? The simplistic overview, very oversimplistic interpretation, is genetics. Well, there are many other things that could explain this, cultural lifestyle factors during pregnancy, behaviors, early life, etc. So I'm going to take you to genetics and epigenetics. So this is a paper that I'm particularly proud of because one of the things at the time, I think this is from 2009, was that there was the belief when I wrote grants and other colleagues here in California wrote grants, the first grant I submitted, you know, for Costa Rica, I got a comment from reviewer one that said, research on COPD genetics should only be done in whites. I still have a copy of that. Happy to show you that. So the thing was, you know, can you do research in a minority population? And some of those findings, are they generalizable? So Steve Shapiro, who's a prior mentor of mine, he's now in Pittsburgh, he was in Boston, had done a lot of work on matrix metalloproteinases, and so that showing that he influences murine emphysema. Subsequent work by Dr. Jack Elias, who was at Yale at the time, showed that also MMPs play a role in IL-13-induced emphysema. So You know, I thought IL-13 is an asthma gene. Could there be some relationship between the two diseases? So we did first the analysis in Costa Rican children and showed that there is a SNP in the promoter of this gene that is positively associated with lung function in kids with asthma in Costa Rica. And then we went to multiple cohorts worldwide, including cohorts in Sweden, North America, and showed the same phenomenon. It was very highly consistent. And then we had data from the normative aging study, which is a study of adults, the Veterans Administration, 40 years and older, who have been followed for 30 years. And they had pulmonary function testing every year. And what we showed in this study is that the same SNP that was associated with higher lung function in Costa Rican kids and other kids was associated with lower risk of COPD over a 30-year period of follow-up. So this is a finding that supports something called the Dodge hypothesis from the 1950s, which says that some kids with asthma are destined to have COPD later in life, right? So after this work, we did some work in other genes like thymic stromal lymphopoietin and then participated in this meta-analysis of ethnically diverse North American populations. And four genes were identified as part of that work, including the most highly replicated gene for asthma, or locus, which is on chromosome 17q21, contains four genes. There was an article that was in the press recently on GSDMB. There's a recent meta-analysis on this gene. So this is very, very highly replicated. And it's mainly associated with childhood onset asthma as opposed to adult onset asthma. So what we did was, you know, early this year, I was fortunate to get several groups to collaborate with our group. And we gathered data from four studies of Puerto Ricans, our own, called Pierre Gall, two studies from UCSF, from Esteban Bercher, my colleague and friend, Gala 1 and Gala 2. And then I also participate in the study of Latinos, which San Diego is a site for. It's a study of adults, 40 and older. And they also had GWAS data. So we put together all of this data and did meta-analysis of GWASs in 5,000 people. And the only locus that was very highly significantly associated with asthma in this cohort was 17q21. We did replicate some of the findings in Europeans. They were in the receptor for IL-1 and TSLP. We did not replicate findings for another gene called IL-33. Now, one thing that we sort of are starting to learn about is that that locus plays a role in airway epithelial integrity, which may be very important in asthma. I have some ongoing work on that. So a couple of postdocs are now doing what we call GWISs, which are genome-wide analysis of gene-by-environment interaction. And things that we're interested in are things like allergens and vitamin D. We're also conducting, I'll tell you a little bit more about that, an epigenome-wide association study in these kids. So in terms of epigenetics, what is epigenetics? Epigenetics refers to changes in gene expression that are not dependent on DNA sequence. There are some important characteristics of epigenetic programming. The first one is that it's modifiable, so potentially we can reprogram that. That's why people are so interested. It can be activated or poised to be activated. But a very, very important thing about epigenetics, and this is what people, you know, I've had conversations with several people here at UCSD about this, is that if you're going to do epigenetics, you have to understand it's cell-specific. It's a very, very important point. So this is a graph to show you this. This is a way the environment can affect a disease like asthma. So during pregnancy, suppose, you know, pregnant woman is exposed to different injuries, allergens, you know, air pollution, environmental tobacco smoke, alterations in diet. And then some alleles through epigenetic programming that say are protective are activated and the child develops no asthma. In a simplistic way, another allele may be suppressed and then this child develops asthma. And there are different ways that epigenetic programming can occur. What I'm going to concentrate on in the next few slides is DNA methylation, which refers to adding a methyl mark to DNA bases. And in general, not always, it reduces gene expression. If, on the other hand, you reduce methylation, it increases gene expression. Again, not always, but often. So the first EWAS, or epigenome-wide association study that we have completed, was on total IgE. And total immunoglobulin is a key intermediate phenotype of both asthma and allergic diseases. It's also quantitative, which is an advantage. It's objective and quantitative. And the reason we did this, it caught my attention that a colleague at Oxford, Dr. Bill Cookson, published a paper in Nature where he reported, he did an EWAS of total IG, and really reported a very high number of CpG sites or DNA methylation signals that were associated with total IG, which is not what you would expect, you know, from experience from genetic studies. And we wonder if that had something to do with the fact that this was conducted in white blood cells, which is an unmixed population of cells. So here's what we did. This is an EWAS of two Hispanic cohorts, our own and Gala, that also includes Mexican kids. And here is the statistical significance at a genome-wide level. So this is the results of our analysis without accounting for cell type. We didn't adjust for the proportion of eosinophils or lymphocyte or whatever. This is expectation. This is how deviated this from expectation. The second plot takes into account cell types. And now you only have four positive signals, which is more in line with, you know, what you would expect in general. So the top genes that we identified in the adjusted analysis are biologically plausible genes. One is single finger protein multi-type 1, CFPM1. It suppresses expression of interleukin-4 and induces expression of interferon gamma in CD4-positive T cells. It reduces TH2 or allergic cell differentiation. The acyl-CoA thioesterase, or ACOT7, has been implicated in asthma by other groups. So this was just published. And briefly, I'll tell you a little bit about vitamin D, very briefly. So this is a child in Costa Rica. He's in a park in San Jose, and he's doing everything he can to increase his vitamin D levels, okay? So if you wear short sleeve T-shirt and short sleeve and shorts, 15 minutes, you know, in a sunny environment like San Diego will do it. You know, you replenish your vitamin D stores. He's also drinking milk fortified with vitamin D, right? Well, you know, this is a study, one in a series of studies we did. This is in Puerto Rico. And we knew from three studies that we conducted in Costa Rica, Puerto Rico, and North America, that low vitamin D levels are associated, consistently associated with severe asthma exacerbations in kids of a school age, 6 to 14. We also know that vitamin D has antioxidant effects. And then the question we had in this particular study was, you know, could vitamin D insufficiency interact with air pollution, you know, to further increase the risk of severe exacerbations? And at that time, what we had was using some geocoding, it's a technique, we had the distance in meters from the child's residence to a major highway as a marker of traffic-related air pollution. And this is the gist of the study. It was conducted by Dr. Rosser, who was one of my fellows. She's now faculty. And here you have kids, as a baseline or comparison, who had sufficient vitamin D levels and who live furthest from a highway. Here you have kids who either had low vitamin D levels or live close to a highway, but not both. And here you have the kids who live close to a highway and had the low vitamin D levels, and the risk of severe exacerbations was increased fivefold. So based on observational data, so the three studies that we had conducted before, I think it's over 2,000 kids, we hypothesized that vitamin D may protect against exacerbations. We believe that the two most likely mechanisms are enhanced response to steroids and immune modulation of common viral illnesses that precipitate asthma attacks. So we are now conducting an NIH-funded trial of 400 kids, a multi-center study, of vitamin D supplementation to prevent severe asthma exacerbations, the vitamin D kid asthma trial. And now I'm going to move over to psychosocial stress and exposure to violence, and it's Dr. Cheng, who's our statistical geneticist and conducted this work. So Puerto Ricans are often exposed to violence where they live in the U.S. Northeast or they live in the island of Puerto Rico. Before Hurricane Maria, 5% of the population had left due to unemployment and crime. You can imagine now there's a massive exodus following the hurricane. We also know that Puerto Ricans appear to be more susceptible to the detrimental effects of violence. If you look at data after the Vietnam War, the veterans that reported the most PTSD symptoms were Puerto Ricans. Following the events of September 11 of 2001, the ethnic group that reported the most PTSD symptoms were Puerto Ricans. Our group and others have linked stress and asthma. The mechanisms for this are unclear. So a colleague of mine, who's now a collaborator, Dr. Kerry Ressler, who's a psychiatrist, he was at Emory when he published his paper in Nature. He's now at Harvard, did this very elegant work where he identified the gene for the receptor of adenylate cyclase activating polypeptide 1 receptor, and I've run out of breath, so I'm going to call it ADCY from now on, has been implicating PTSD in heavily traumatized women. That was the first paper. It was a second paper by one of his junior faculty where he also showed this is implicated in anxiety in children. So the question, and this is, to me, this one part of this work, I think it took him 5.5 years, but this is a plot of methylation of the receptor of this gene versus a quantitative scale of PTSD symptoms. And what he found is as the promoter of the gene was more methylated, PTSD symptoms increased. To my knowledge, this was the first report in the human literature of a relationship of any type between stress or stress-related disorder and DNA methylation. So the question then we had is, here we have this Puerto Rican cohort. We know they are highly exposed to violence. Could there be any relationship between, you know, ADCY, methylation, and asthma? So this is the first part of the paper. We had a scale to measure exposure to violence, and it was linearly associated with DNA methylation of a CpG site in the promoter of ADCY. Methylation of the gene was associated with 30% increased odds of asthma in these kids. And not shown here, the same SNP in the gene that Ressler had implicated in PTSD was associated with asthma in these kids. So to my knowledge, this was the first study to provide a potential genetic or epigenetic basis for the association between stress and childhood asthma. Of course, it's a cross-sectional study, so longitudinal studies are needed. That was the conclusion at the time. Now, here is a child using his inhaler incorrectly, right? So that's why I showed you the slides. He should have a spacer. But one thing that is also known about Puerto Rican children and adults is they respond to albuterol less well than people, members of other ethnic groups. So this reduced response to bronchodilators was initially attributed to mutations in the gene for the beta-2 adrenergic receptor by my colleague Burchard. And then I ran, as I was writing one of these grants, you know, I ran into this paper by somebody who's also a collaborator now, Greg Miller, who's at Northwestern. And Greg had published this paper in PNAS, where he did this most fascinating experiment. He had white blood cells of kids with asthma, and he had data on stress, chronic and acute. So the kids were divided into four groups according to where they had chronic stress, acute stress, or no chronic or acute stress, right? And it turns out that the kids who had chronic and acute stress, the expression of their gene for the beta-2 adrenergic receptor was reduced ninefold. So in reading this paper, I said, boy, you know, could we test this in our cohort? And this is what we found. So on top, you have 234 kids in our cohort who had BDR data. And in those kids, high levels of chronic stress were associated with a reduction 3.9% in BDR. To put this into context, in kids this age, 8% is what we consider a significant response for research studies. So this is almost 50% of a clinical significant or a research significant response. And then we went to a second cohort. So this is the Rhode Island Puerto Rico Asthma Center. They have Puerto Ricans, Dominicans, and whites living in Rhode Island and Puerto Rico. And they had data on anxiety disorder, panic disorder, on both. And the kids who had anxiety and panic disorder had a 4.4% reduction in BDR. So what any member of the audience could then say, I said, well, you know, you're finding this because the child is stressed, the mother is stressed, and therefore they are not using their controller medications. Of course, you know, they have reduced BDR. So what we did to try to address that was to go to a national study called NHANES. And we found a group of kids who had a low FEV1 FVC, but no diagnosis of asthma and were on no asthma medications. So they had evidence of early airway obstruction, but no disease. And in those kids, high levels of anxiety, chronic anxiety, were also associated with reduced BDR. Moreover, we then went to the gene, the ADCY gene that we had implicated in asthma, And we got data from, I think it was 2,743 kids with BDR, multiple ethnicities across the country. And this SNP in ADCY is associated with 1% reduction in BDR. And you would say, boy, that's a small effect. It's not, you know, for genetics or complex traits. I would not call that a small effect. The final piece of this work is Kerry Ressler had data on functional MRIs of 44 black women living in inner city Atlanta, and in whom he also had genetic data. And what he what we found was that the people, the woman who had the risk allele for reduced BDR, also had increased functional connectivity of the amygdala and the insula, which in humans is a marker of anxiety. Now shown here, we also showed a significant gene by stress interaction on BDR in our cohort, meaning the kids who had the risk SNP and had high levels of stress had greater reduction in BDR. So how do we interpret all of these together? I didn't show you this, but the SNP also affects the expression of ADRB2. It's called a trans effect. So we think that what's happening is there is a negative effect of the SNP and also of chronic stress on BDR through neurohormonal mechanisms, where it is persistent secretion of catecholamines, and that leads to downregulation of ADRB2. That's the best way we can put these together. We, of course, realize that some of this can be extended to other diseases where beta receptors are important, like cardiovascular disease. So now I'm going to tell you a little bit about a study in adults just to cement what I had said previously. So through a collaboration with Dr. De La Hoz in New York, he has access to the World Trade Center cohort. This is a cohort of rescue and recovery workers who attended to the events of 9/11. And we know that PTSD in adults has also been associated with asthma in cross-sectional or snapshot studies. We wanted to look at this in a longitudinal way. So what's the relation between probable PTSD at baseline and incident or new-onset asthma after 4.5 years of follow-up in this cohort of about 3,800 World Trade Center workers? And this is what we found. The workers who had probable PTSD at baseline had a 2.4 increased odds of developing asthma over 4.5 years of follow-up after taking into account, you know, many potential confounders. So this just further adds to a growing body of evidence that is still ongoing to support a relationship between psychosocial stress and the pathogenesis of asthma. I didn't discuss prenatal stress in this talk, but my colleague Ross Wright at Mount Sinai, she was previously at Harvard, has done extensive work on that, and her work also suggests that that's possible. Now I'm going to move to obesity, and this is Dr. Eric Forno, who's originally from Peru, and he's one of my most talented mentees. So back in 2011, Eric did a study where he showed for the first time that kids who were overweight or obese, these are North American kids followed over 4 years, had reduced response to inhaled steroids. More recently, Dr. Delumetsu's group, Boston Children's, did this murine model of obesity-induced airway responsiveness, or you know, you could say murine asthma. And what he showed in this paper was that this disease was not dependent on Th2 allergic mechanisms, but rather on Th17 and inflammasome mechanisms. Th17 pathways are typically associated with reduced response to a steroid, which is kind of interesting. So I, with Dr. Jay Coles, who's now in Tulane, we wrote an editorial on this paper. And then, you know, knowing this, it's a serendipity, I knew that in the NHANES nationwide study, I could kind of look at this in kids, and we did. Why were we able to do this? Because in this nationwide study of several thousand kids, they measure exhaled nitric oxide. And exhaled nitric oxide is a measure of eosinophilic airway inflammation. So no matter which study you look at, in which ethnic group, obesity and adiposity measures are associated with asthma. This is true in kids, it's true in adults. Weight gain is also associated with asthma. Some studies suggest that it's stronger in females than in males, but it's very consistent. Now, we analyzed this data. There were four markers of adiposity, but we stratified or divided the data by the kids who had high exhaled nitric oxide or potential allergic airway inflammation and the kids who had low exhaled nitric oxide. What did we find? Well, in the kids who had low exhaled nitric oxide, right, there was a linear relationship between BMI and asthma. This was true for another three indicators of adiposity, waist hip circumference, you know, waist hip ratio, very consistent. But in the kids who had allergic airway inflammation, this was flat, right? Which is consistent with the murine model. It suggests that this is a disease of this asthma that is mediated through mechanisms other than allergy, at least its development or inception. So since then, Eric just recently published another paper looking at obesity and a phenomenon called airway dyssynapsis, which was first described by Jerry Mead at Harvard. So dyssynapsis is an incongruence in lung growth whereby the lung volumes grow faster than the airway caliber. So the patients have low FEV1 FVC, but they have a normal FEV1 FVC. So we'll look at BMI. We'll also look at obesity versus airway dyssynapsis. We had data from six cohorts of children in the U.S. and worldwide with and without asthma, about 4,000 kids. We did a cross-sectional and longitudinal analysis. And then in kids with asthma, we look at dyssynapsis versus clinical outcomes. The first part of the paper showed, we demonstrated that BMI and obesity are in fact associated with airway dyssynapsis, both in boys and girls. But then we also showed that airway dyssynapsis was associated with severe exacerbations and use of oral steroids for asthma in these kids. So obese asthma, the way you know we're thinking about this, is a very common entity. Probably you all have seen it, or every general pediatrician has seen it in this audience. And it's more common among economically disadvantaged and minorities. Not all obese asthma is the same. So you could also have the phenomenon where you have a kid of atopy, allergic asthma, who then becomes obese, or who has obesity and then becomes atopic and it's worse. So there are different phenotypes. That's what Eric is working on. But the important part of this is that prevention of obesity is very highly important. Once you have a kid with obese asthma, they are very difficult to treat at this point. And in those who have obese asthma, weight management cannot be overemphasized. So if the final part of this talk is briefly talking a little bit more, going back to the original idea of health disparities. So here is a paper we wrote from the American Thoracic Society, a position paper on respiratory health equality. An environment and lifestyle or behavioral factor explain about 95% of these disparities. It's predominantly things that can be modified. And I talk about obesity, and obesity is a risk factor for asthma morbidity, for asthma and asthma morbidity. But the easier thing to do is to just look at the surface when you're looking at these disparities, the symptom or of the problem, the wheat. This is the obvious. Oh, a kid is obese, you know, the parents are not doing a good job, whatever, you know, that's why they have more asthma. But you have to look at the underlying causes or the root, what's below the surface, what's not obvious. So here's a map of LA, and it looks like economic hardship and childhood obesity. Where do you think the obese children are more likely to live? In economically deprived areas, right? As programs for physical education, and as these kids get fed sodas and all this, forgive me, garbage, you know, they are more likely to become overweight and obese. So in this position paper, you know, this is just intuitively, right? So one of the things that we emphasized was pursue environmental justice. Everybody in this audience knows that the environment is under attack. Under the current leader of the EPA, Scott Pruitt, a great degree of damage has been done already, and I'm afraid it will continue to be done, and voices have to be raised. Advocacy, and we said advocacy at the local, state, and national levels, what we call the lung corps there. Of course, access, another thing that is under attack, and excellency in healthcare is very important. And research is the engine for innovation, to do things better every day for these kids. Everything ends up promoting a healthy lifestyle. So in terms of improving care, I would just show you one paper from Costa Rica because I think it's interesting. There is evidence from multiple studies worldwide, including by my colleague Michel Cloutier in Hartford, Connecticut, which is the poorest city of its size in the Northeast, showing that if primary care providers prescribe more controller medications, and particularly inhaled steroids, you can impact ED visits and hospitalizations in inner city areas. So we had data on temporal trends in actual morbidity and mortality in Costa Rica, which is a country that has universal access to healthcare. In 1948, President Figueres abolished the army in Costa Rica and decreed universal healthcare. If you're a Costa Rica citizen, you're taken care of. 5 years later, he nationalized education. The literacy rate in Costa Rica is 97%, which is higher than certain areas of this country like East LA or the Bronx. It is a shame. So what did we find? Manuel Soto, my friend in Costa Rica, launched a national education plan for children and adults in 2003, targeting providers. At that point, the government only allowed specialists to prescribe inhaled steroids. Only allergists or pulmonologists could prescribe inhaled steroids. This was abolished in 2004. And then you can see how the prescriptions for beclomethasone, which was what the government paid for, this is the deal they made, it's a relatively cheap inhaled steroids, went way up. Whereas other things that are more expensive, like Montelukast or formoterol, remain relatively flat. This is ecological data, but nonetheless, it's very striking. So here you have mortality trends in different age groups and different genders, and everything went down after inhaled steroids went up. This has been shown in other countries like Chile and around the world. So I talk about research. This is a paper that we published with Esteban Burchard and others 2 years back. What did we look at? In 1993, there was a legislative mandate to include women and minorities in NIH-funded studies. So we did a PubMed search looking at all NIH-funded studies on respiratory diseases published since 1993. So what's happened with inclusion of minorities? Look at that. 20 years later, people are laughing, and they're not including these minorities. People are not being included. There is a slight increase in Hispanics. Esteban always jokes that it's he and I, in all these studies, and therefore that has gone up a little bit. But we have, with some groups, it's really sad, like Native Americans, which would be another group that is really not included. As long as this continues, progress is going to be very, very difficult. So I go back to this, and there are two ways of looking at this. There is the fatalistic view that seems to permeate this country these days. And then there is the traditional American view, the land where the impossible becomes possible. Do not tell me that the country that put a man on the moon and won two world wars cannot solve this problem. Of course we can. Paraphrasing President Johnson, solving this problem is what America is about. It is the uncrossed desert and the unclimbed ridge. It is a star that cannot be reached and the harvest sleeping in the unplowed ground. Is our old world gone? We say farewell. Is a new world coming? We welcome it and we shall shape it to the hopes of men. You're only as good as the people you surround yourself with. I'm blessed with having many collaborators around the world. I'm very fortunate, and they are listed here. And this is the dogma that has shaped my career. Do unto others as you would like to be done to you. Thank you very much, and God bless you all.
Amazing lecture. Thank you for that. Asthma is multifactorial, and one of the things I'm interested in, those who know me, is breastfeeding. And there's been controversy whether breastfeeding protects against asthma or not. However, recently, that just came out in JPs, was a very interesting article from Canada, so not a very diverse population, that suggested that direct breastfeeding at 3 months, where they were not receiving express breast milk, was protective, versus those who either were not breastfed or fed formula breast milk or actually received only breast milk in a bottle. And with everything you've said, I'm wondering if you have any comments as to why that is, because it was quite a striking result in my mind.
So you have touched one of the most controversial areas in all of asthma epidemiology, right? Because there are studies showing that it protects. As you said, there are studies that are flat, your studies are... I've always believed that the problem with the studies that have been done to date, right, is that it's critical to look at the introduction of foodstuff and when foodstuff is introduced. That's been a major confounder of all these breastfeeding studies. I'm pretty sure that the study you're referring to is by Malcolm Sears, you know, who's a good friend. He's a Canadian epidemiologist, and he spent his entire life, you know, doing breastfeeding and asthma. And I think that's what they are trying to do, if I remember correctly. You know, they are getting exquisite data on diet, postnatal diet. Our own observations in this cohort were that kids who were breastfed for, I think, up to 4 months, you know, that there was an inverse relationship, a suggestion of a protective effect in these Puerto Rican kids. So we did publish one paper on that. One back.
Thank you for a great talk. I was fascinated by the different phenotypes of asthma and was wondering how would you relate that back to the different ethnic groups and ancestries and if you related it back to different genetics and epigenetics markers.
So I think that's sort of the goal. You know, one thing that we're very excited, we're about to finish, is we completed a whole genome-wide epigenetic study in two tissues in these kids. One is nasal epithelium, which is a surrogate of bronchial epithelium. And the other one is white blood cells with all the caveats that I just showed you. So we did that. We also did gene expression. We did RNA sequencing. And we have some very exciting results. So one of the most difficult things in asthma, and this is why we're so excited, is prediction. You know, that's what we're very interested in, going back to clinical work, right? So can we develop a panel of markers, this has been the holy grail, that can tell a pediatrician which baby who's wheezing at age one will develop true asthma, right? Which may impact how you treat that kid. How can we predict whether a kid will respond to inhaled steroids or not, right? Well, you should try something else. This is what this work is about. So in this panel, we have the first kind of set of predictors. I think it's pretty good. You know, we've tested this to death, so we're very comfortable with it. So we're just about to finalize that paper. I have another study that is starting in February. It was delayed because of the hurricane, where we're getting 300 kids with asthma, and we're measuring the levels of stress. Everybody gets the same inhaled steroid. We're going to assess response to a steroid. So the question in that grant is twofold. The first one is, does a stress reduce response to inhaled steroids? Which I think it will, based on some experimental data. And two, can we develop a panel using these genetic and epigenetic markers of response to steroids? So we're thinking along the same lines. And it's possible that for different ethnic groups, this may vary a little bit. So.
I have a question regarding the future of clinical trials based on which the last slide you showed, but also a lot of the therapeutic clinical trials. Right now, I mean, they break it down. I mean, there's categories that they need to meet in each bucket in terms of age, in terms of gender, but really, if you look at all the biologic trials, they have not set quotas for different ethnicities. So we really don't have a great representation. I mean, because only if you do that will you be able to then show the responses.
You're absolutely right. And this has been a huge problem, right? So one thing that I've argued with, I can tell you openly, right, that this paper did not make me very popular with NHLBI. I got an enormous amount of backlash. Now we're cool, as you would say in the West Coast, but but they were very unhappy, you know. And one way you can sort of deal with that is what people do is exactly what you're saying, right? They have to fill a quota. So they have 1,000 patients. They include 20 Mexicans, 5 Japanese, and then they said, oh, you know, include minorities, right? And you can draw absolutely no conclusions. And then what they always do is they exclude the minorities, right, because they were not power. It's a very perverse game. So I've always advocated for do it well. So do a study like the ones I've shown you where you have a large proportion of people on the same group. So do a study of African-Americans. Do a large study of Hispanics like Seoul. You know, and then you will have enough people to draw conclusions. But we have to keep, you know, pushing for that. Yeah.
My question is looking at the link between anxiety and asthma. Is there a proposed biological mechanism to explain that relationship or what's happening at a more cellular, molecular level?
So that's what we're sort of trying to do. You know, so I really think, and somebody, I think Dr. Haywood raised this question, right, is I We have some more work to do, but I believe that chronic stress, you know, high levels of stress, that's altered gene expression. So I think that's how this is operating. So there is another grant that, you know, again, I don't have to show you all this, but we have another grant looking at what we call social epigenomics. So NIH just funded us to look at our data on violence and stress in relation to genome-wide methylation. So the idea is look at that, take the top methylation signals, and then relate them back to asthma, right? So I think at the end we'll find out a network, a pathway, you know, of stress-related genes that may influence this stress-related asthma. Maybe. We'll see.
Well, we're out of time, but I'd like to thank Dr. Sullivan for a really excellent talk.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.